WBAI.org on the web. I'm Michael G. Haskins here in studio this morning with Pam Brown.
Good morning, Amin. So just to jump right in, we were talking about this new report on the just disgusting Wall Street bonuses, which turned out to be twice the total annual earnings of all Americans in the entire country working full time at the minimum wage. And I thought we could lead in with maybe discussing some of the activities that happened on May Day last week. Perhaps you can share a little bit about the activity that we were involved in.
Yeah, I mean, so part of what we did on May Day was, and we organized for this for a while, but it was in relation to the Guggenheim. The Guggenheim Museum is building a branch in Abu Dhabi using migrant labor from South Asia, paying them very little. These workers kind of get there through agents the workers themselves end up paying money to get a job. And then when they get over to Abu Dhabi from very poor areas, from Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Nepal, they are put in worker camps. Their passports are taken. They're in a direct relationship with their employer, and they can't really change employers, and they don't have a right to organize. What's interesting about, you know, we often talk about Palestine in this segment, but what's interesting is Palestine highlights the form of oppression, of colonialism, settler colonialism with apartheid, with illegal occupation. And Abu Dhabi, which is, you know, a desert area kind of created by, after colonialism, it was part of the British Empire. And what you see over there is just like racialized capitalism, the stratification being made as cities are being built in kind of, you know, in these desert areas where there really isn't any economic activity to justify the kind of thing, other than to say you have the 1% of the 1%, which is royal families that were selected by these colonial rulers to kind of maintain their influence in a more neo-colonial structure. Anyway, on May Day, the basic point was that we went out in solidarity with these workers as a way to kind of pressure a 1% institution that in a way we kind of care about, because as an artist, it is part of a community where it does cultural and educational work. And trying to hold them to that standard or that banner that they have raised and say, you know what, these workers, if they're going to build a museum, they need to have a living wage and they should not be in debt bondage in order to build your museum. And they should have a right to collectively address their grievances.
And
so we occupied the Guggenheim, physically occupied the Guggenheim, shut it down for the entire day. And told them we would be back if they didn't adhere to these demands, which are all within their control.
And a couple of interesting things about what happened. One, it was that art was really created within the museum, in the sense that there were different levels of ways that the museum's space was occupied, from sound to the visual space.
You mean on that day?
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm sure that Amin can speak to this and can speak to the fact that artists created the banner that was used to and it was a specific banner, a specific shape, to resonate very much with the space itself. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the thoughtfulness that went into the choice of how to orchestrate that event that Amin was one of the key organizers of.
I mean, it was very important when we went into this space to kind of play off of the show or the art that was in the space. So on Kuara's show, you know, he was kind of a minimalist conceptual artist with a lot of monochrome paintings of dates, numerics, throughout kind of his life. And so one very important concept that we came up with was rather than, you know, 01 period, you know, which would be January 15 period, and then the year, we said May Day, so we used letters, and we wrote 2015. All our signs, protest signs or flyers, were monochrome. And so it really kind of fit right into the space. And then the very large banner that Pam mentions was a huge banner kind of on a parachute that we dyed and wrote kind of, and it was circular to resonate with the space of the Guggenheim. All of these things is like we created art and brought it in because we wanted to play off of the vocabulary and the history and make it, you know, aesthetically beautiful and thoughtful, while at the same time escalating in our tactics to pressure the Guggenheim, not only hit its brand, but hit its pocket. And this is not like something where it's like it came out of nowhere. We've been in conversation with the Guggenheim for years. And there's been a boycott in place, and we've met with Richard Armstrong, and we've pleaded.
Richard Armstrong is?
He's the chairman of the Guggenheim. I mean, the person that kind of is the point person, deals with everything, reports to the trustees.
And one of the interesting things is that even though in the end, I think there were only maybe 12 of us who were really so-called occupying the space, and anyone in New York knows that obviously the Guggenheim is a large, has a large entryway, a large sort of foyer area at the base, which 12 people, I mean, I'm sure that you could have hundreds of people, frankly, fit into that space. So 12 unarmed, nonviolent protesters in that space doesn't really represent much of a threat, in a sense, to the Guggenheim in any kind of physical way, at least. Yet they did make the decision that they would allow us to stay within the space and that they would not allow literally thousands of people into the museum that day. And we calculated on the fly, and it may, and this may or may not be an accurate calculation, that at the $26 that they charge now to get into the museum, they had to have lost at least probably $18,000-$20,000 just in those hours.
But I have to ask you both this. Were the Guggenheim is a really high-profile institution in New York City. Were the police called? Was there anything, any intervention from the police? Did the Guggenheim administration just continue, you know, negotiating and talking with you, Amin? Or were the police called?
Police were called. And, you know, there was a standoff with the police. But we knew we were in a kind of public-private space that it would require the Guggenheim to make a really kind of a direct order to the police to arrest us. What the Guggenheim ended up doing is kind of an in-between position where they refused to talk to us because we went in with a specific demand, which is that we would like to speak, we would like to leave with a commitment by the Guggenheim for a meeting with us and the Board of Trustees to discuss the demands of the workers. They refused to speak to any of us while we were in the space during the entire time. But at the same time, they called off the cops when they realized that we had entered with the intention not to be deterred by arrests. Mm.
And what happened to the banner, Amin?
Well, this is a key point, and now we're really thinking about the next steps. I think, Pam, what you were alluding to even before this idea of the banner is why would they shut down the museum in the face of thousands of people because of 12 people who are sitting on the floor of the museum in a circle discussing this issue and actually just like almost like in sit-in form wanting to speak with the administration of the Guggenheim? And I think the answer is related to partly to the banner in some way. But whatever was happening in that space at that time, one would say was art. right? Just in general, because Absolutely. It was in relation to art, it was about culture, it was in the Guggenheim space. And this banner that people worked on for about, I'd say, a month in terms of concept, that it resonates with the space, that it really is. Someone, even a museum goer, said that this is probably the best Ankuwara art I've ever seen, right? So we were making art there, and that art got destroyed because as soon as the banner was unfurled, the guards destroyed it violently, with scissors, which was kind of odd that they would use such a dangerous instrument amongst people in a chaotic situation. But it's not that we fault the guards. We fault the institution that has these kind of guidelines as to how to deal with situations in the space.
Yeah.
But at any rate, this banner, one would argue, is worth millions.
Yeah.
Especially on like a day that an event like this happened at the Guggenheim, and it was all part of, a history, a moment.
Yep. I mean, I think that this opens up a lot of important questions that are discussed within academic kinds of spaces, but not necessarily within the public space where they really ought to be discussed, about what really constitutes art and who has the power to create what art is and what's considered art. And how is that power institutionalized within spaces such as the Guggenheim? And what is the relationship of that power to workers, to how we live, not only here in the United States, and in this case, especially not here in the United States, but in places that want to constitute their nationalism in some sense around having this cultural capital of something of an institution like the Guggenheim, which has the ability to codify at some level what art is.
I think that the Guggenheim really kind of wants to have a monopoly on that.
They have
and
that.
This is, and, Yeah, right, and made to me exactly to maintain it. And I think it's a threat to every cultural institution that, in fact, is currently embedded in this kind of oppressive system, not only of people here in terms of the class inequality that's continuing, but, internationally.